This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. The Obamas have spent the last two Thanksgivings at the White House. No word yet on this year's location. If it's Camp David, then the White House chef gets to rest. The Navy cook is there. So reports NPR's special correspondent, Susan Stamberg. A notorious Thanksgiving fan, she got two former White House chefs to chat about the holiday in front of an audience and to tell some first family food stories.
We met on stage at the National Archives Auditorium, several hundred people there for our public chat. Clip-on mics, so the sound's not great, but the stories are. Pastry chef Roland Mesnier. He baked for Presidents Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2. Told about one executive chef who didn't last very long at the White House after he made turkey one Thanksgiving, sliced it, and arranged it on a platter.
The platter looked like he had taken the turkey and stuck a stick of dynamite in a turkey's rear hand, and whatever came out, put it on the platter. Needless to say, at the time, the First Lady was Mrs. Reagan.
Oh, she would not have liked fire.
No, she was not not very fond of that.
Yeah.
And, of course, that chef was passing like a flash through the White House.
That Thanksgiving was not a total loss, however, according to Chef Mesnier.
Luckily, we had a great dessert to save them. This is where the pastry chef comes in. Clean up after the chef.
And what was the dessert?
It was a pumpkin ice cream dessert.
Oh.
That Mrs. Reagan told me never to do it again.
Well, I had a secret agenda for beginning with Thanksgiving. Every year, I give my late mother-in-law, Marjorie Stamberg's, recipe for cranberry relish. And each year I am challenged with a fresh and new way to present this recipe. So last year I got a rap singer to do it for me. And he rhymed relish with fetish.
That's what y'all heard. With some cranberries, a little bit of onion, y'all, and some horseradish. Now I got a fetish for that relish, and it's pink.
But this year, I have two former White House chefs captive in front of an audience to help. Frank Ruta, who cooked for the Carters, Reagans, and Bush 1s, gave my ingredients.
2 cups whole raw cranberries washed, 1 small onion, 3/4 cup sour cream, 1/2 cup sugar, 2 tablespoons horseradish from a jar.
White House Chef Mesnier tells the procedure.
Remember, I don't have my glasses on.
Uh-oh, do you want mine?
Grind the raw berries and onions together. Everything else and mixed. Put in a plastic container and freeze. Early Thanksgiving morning.
He's got it. And doesn't this weird recipe sound great with a French accent? So, move it from the freezer to the regular fridge to thaw. It will be chunky, icy, and the color of, yes, Pepto-Bismol.
Creamy and shocking pink. And after that, just throw it out. No, I take that back. It's delicious. Remind me of the Carter's cream cheese ring.
Frank Ruta remembers that one.
We had a cheddar cheese ring that Mrs. Carter would serve as a mainstay for an hors d'oeuvre party. And it was very simple. It was cheddar cheese, grated, and it was mayonnaise, and it was pimentos. And it was in a ring, and it was served with strawberry preserves. In the center.
Which nobody ate.
Yeah.
I think we made one and keep bringing it out. Yeah. Kind of like the fruitcake.
Yeah.
We froze it, bring it out, and I bet you go back to the White House freezer today, you still find a Carter cheese there.
Yes, friends, you heard it here. Good taxpayers' money going for a cheddar cheese ring. Well, not exactly. The first family pays for family food. Which means that once upon a time, Richard Nixon shelled out perfectly good cash for his favorite lunch of cottage cheese with ketchup. Watching his weight, no doubt. Ingredients arrive at the White House every day. Roland Mesnier says the buying and delivering system is efficient and secure.
It's very simple. They buy the food. Nobody knows from where it is. Somebody pick up the food, unmarked truck. People that pick up the food, you'll never know that's going to go to the White House.
When food arrives any other way, gifts of fresh strawberries, Girl Scout Samoas, the order is destroy. In 1987, President Reagan held a state dinner for Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. After Gorbachev went home, pastry chef Mesnier was in the White House kitchen on a Friday afternoon talking with executive chef Hans Raffert when a package arrived.
And the head usher came down with a big brown box, and he said to both of us, he said, "I want you to destroy what is inside the box." Mm. That box came straight from the Kremlin. So we opened the box, and we find two tins inside, filled with 7-pound caviar. Now, I look at the chef, and I said, "Hans, I don't know about you, but I'm willing to die for that."
These White House chefs learned how to tell what the first family liked. They would watch to see how their plates came back from the dining room. Empty? They liked it. Asked for seconds? They liked it. Now, over the years, you would think I would learn a similar lesson in my Thanksgiving kitchen if, so unlikely, my plates come back with little shocking pink blobs. Do I stop making Mama Stamberg's cranberry relish? Not on your life. And you won't either once you check out the recipe at NPR.org. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Time now for your letters. Last Saturday, we brought you a story about a new museum opening in Bentonville, Arkansas, the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, which is funded by Walmart heiress Alice Walton. Danny McKinney of Dunkirk, New York, writes, "How ambitious to decide to create an amazing art museum in a place between the coasts, accessible to everyone, and the price of admission, free." Nancy Gray of Madison, Wisconsin, had a different take. She writes, "It's wonderful that Ms. Walton is bringing culture to her city, but imagine what a portion of that money could do to improve the quality of life of hardworking employees at the Walmarts across the country. It was announced earlier this month that Walmart would no longer offer health insurance benefits to its part-time workers." Many listeners shared their love of autumn in response to my essay on the simple joys of the season. Michael Ale of Issaquah, Washington, sent this note, "I connected immediately with Linda's essay on autumn, her appreciation for a singular maple leaf, the claiming of this ideal time of year between Halloween and Thanksgiving. That essay included one of my childhood memories of the season, the house filled with the scent of bourbon as my mom made fruitcakes for my dad's customers at his neighborhood grocery store. That prompted Gary Cook of Seattle, Washington, to write, "As a fan of that much-maligned food group, the fruitcake, I wish you would share the recipe. All day today I've been trying to imagine the aroma of lemons and bourbon rising from a light golden cake. Thank you for all your kind words. My mother's recipe made 40 fruitcakes, but she slimmed it down before she gave it to me, and you can find it at NPR.org. Finally, lots of comments on our website following our interview marking the 40th anniversary of the Led Zeppelin classic Stairway to Heaven, including this one from Jerry B. of Philadelphia. "I hate to admit it, but this song probably caused me to become a guitarist in the 80s, a phenomenon so ubiquitous it was satirized by Mike Myers' Wayne's World in a scene at a music store where his character is stopped mid-strum and shown a sign on the wall that says, 'No Stairway to Heaven.'"
There's a sign on the wall, but she wants to be sure, 'cause you know sometimes words have to mean.
No restrictions on your comments, though. We welcome your letters. To write us, visit our website, NPR.org, and click on the Contact Us link. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at NPR Weekend. This is NPR News.
Now, something completely unfair, something sure to make your mouth water. Listen to this description of a rising star in the apple world, an apple called Sweet Tango.
Sweet Tango has much larger cells than other apples, and when you bite into it, the cells shatter rather than cleaving along the cell walls, as is the case with most popular apples. The bursting of the cells fills your mouth with juice. Chunks of Sweet Tango snap off in your mouth with a loud cracking sound. Although a crisp texture is the single most prized quality in an apple, even more desirable than taste, according to one study, crispness is more a matter of acoustics than mouthfeel. Vibrations pass along the lower jaw and set the cochlea trembling.
That's New Yorker writer John Seabrook reading from his article titled Crunch in this week's Food Issue. And John Seabrook, you're describing this apple really like almost like a starlet. You describe her sunburned shoulders and her freckles. Born in Minnesota, this apple?
She's born in Minnesota, bred in Minnesota. Her mother is the Honeycrisp, which a lot of people know and love. And her father is an apple called the Zestar, which is also around, but people don't know it quite as well.
So that's the parentage right there.
Right.
Sweet Tango has her, it's hard not to think of it as a her, has her own Twitter feed and her own Facebook page.
She's a very modern apple. As I said in the article, she's more like the apple on my laptop than the apple I used to carry in my lunchbox.
When you describe the sound of biting into this apple, you write that it's like hearing with your mouth or tasting music. What about the taste? What does Sweet Tango taste like?
Well, it is sweet, like Honeycrisp, but it also has this great sort of lemony finish, almost a tropical taste that I think cuts the sweetness and really makes it just very memorable. And the flesh of it is also very crisp, and it's got a kind of a powdery texture to it, which I think tastes really nice and clean and just really a delightful experience eating one.
Okay, now apart from the qualities that make this apple remarkable, your story is also a business story because Sweet Tango has a trademark. It's what's called a managed apple. Why don't you explain what that means?
Well, as most people who shop for apples have probably observed, in the last 10 years or so, a lot of new varieties have come into the supermarkets with names like Pink Lady, Gala, Jazz. Sweet Tango is kind of the next of those modern apples that are all trademarked. They also all are patented, of course. Growers have to pay the university, in this case, for a license to grow the tree, and they're trademarked. So they also have to pay a royalty on the number of apples that they sell.
I'd never thought about the business of apples in quite this way. The university here is the University of Minnesota, which has a very active apple breeding program, and they have set up a consortium, right, to market and grow.
Right. So the deal is that the Honeycrisp apple was released in an open release, and that meant that anybody who wanted to could grow it anywhere they wanted to grow it in any way they wanted to grow it. And that meant that the quality of the Honeycrisp varied widely. So with the new apple, with the Sweet Tango, the university decided they were going to manage the release, and that meant that in order to grow the apple, you have to be granted the right to grow it by this consortium. And if they don't like where you're growing it or who you are or what your track record is, they won't give you that license. Also, it means that you can't sell your apples to a supermarket. You have to sell them to the consortium, and they do the marketing. Overall, it's an attempt to control the quality of the apple and ensure the long-term longevity of the brand.
You know, we wanted to find some Sweet Tangos to taste for ourselves, but we are out of luck. I guess the season's over. We're going to have
to wait till
next
year.
And
that's kind of it's too bad for you, but it's kind of a cool thing. It's like the old days, you know. You get it when it's in the stores, and when the season's over, you just got to wait till next year.
It's John Seabrook. His article about the Sweet Tango apple in this week's New Yorker magazine is titled Crunch. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Melissa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Another dilemma facing parents is whether to allow their kids to drink chocolate milk. Many school districts are eliminating chocolate milk from cafeterias on the grounds that it has too much sugar and calories. But another segment of the population, runners and endurance athletes, can't seem to get enough. NPR's Allison Aubrey checks in with both camps.
When Dan DeFonso ran past the 26-mile mark at the Wine Glass Marathon in Corning, New York earlier this month, and he caught a glimpse of the finish line, he expected the tables of water and Gatorade. But what was handed to him?
As soon as I crossed the finish line, I received my finisher's medal, which I was happy to see. But the very next person handed me a plastic jug of chocolate milk. It was delicious.
DeFonso says he's always been a fan. As a kid, he loved chocolate milk. But he says only recently have runners turned to chocolate milk as a recovery drink.
I just think in years past, you would have been a little bit strange if you were to drink chocolate milk immediately after a run. But nowadays, it's absolutely mainstream, and I think everybody's just looking to find out, you know, what's that one beverage I can take that makes me feel better the next day so I can run again, and chocolate milk's been doing that for me, so I stick with it.
A spate of new research studies seems to be fueling the trend. One study found that the protein in milk speeds up the time it takes muscles to recover from intense exercise. And another study, perhaps of interest to lots of us who aren't in the habit of running 26 miles, finds that chocolate may play a role in helping people manage their weight. Researcher Josh Lambert of Penn State says it's complicated, but he's studying the unusual way that chocolate interacts with a specific digestive enzyme to block the absorption of fat.
These compounds in cocoa, these polyphenolic compounds in cocoa, inhibit the activity of that enzyme, so they block it from breaking down fat.
Basically helping the body fend off fat. But don't get too excited. It'll take more research to see how big this effect is. So here's the rub. Whatever boost the good compounds in chocolate may give us, the bum rap that chocolate milk is getting in schools is due to all the extra sugar and added calories.
In my world, chocolate milk is soda and drag. Most of it has as much sugar as actually Pepsi or Coke, and it doesn't belong in schools.
That's Ann Cooper, who directs food services at the Boulder Valley School District in Colorado. She's made a national reputation for herself as the renegade lunch lady, tapping into the national angst over how kids eat. And in her mind, tossing out chocolate milk is one easy step to address the very complicated obesity problem. Other schools are taking action, too, from L.A. to Minneapolis and D.C. There's a national rethink over chocolate milk, and even famous TV foodies are taking up the cause.
Please welcome Chef Jamie Oliver.
Chocolate milk was the focus of his appearance on the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
So what I'm saying is the parents of L.A. and America need to start giving a about what we feed kids.
That's right. And
So it's a really good idea, right? You ban chocolate milk and schools are doing something to make kids healthier. But it's not so simple. At least that's what Penny McConnell of the Fairfax County, Virginia school says she learned.
When we eliminated it, we had as many parents who were upset with us that we did it as the ones who were pleased with it.
Some were worried that their kids weren't getting enough calcium.
I've tried regular. I don't really like it, so.
Claire Feidler says some kids won't drink milk if it's not chocolate, and her schoolmate Zachary Dondershine agrees.
I just think it tastes better. More people like chocolate more, and it has more sugar in it.
So McConnell had an idea. Why not keep the chocolate and replace the sugar? She worked with her dairy suppliers to eliminate high fructose corn syrup. Her reformulated skim chocolate milk does have sugar in it, but it only has 30 extra calories compared to a half pint of regular 1% milk. Mom Diane Dondershine says that works for her.
I'm fine with that, as long as they're getting calcium.
McConnell says what she's learned is that banning a food may not be as helpful as the much more complicated task of teaching kids to look at their whole plates and make good choices. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.